Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Guys, this is Succession. This is HBO. If you don't want to hear me talking about Logan Roy, talking about then don't listen to this. There are bad language words in this show. Hello, and welcome back to Slate Money Succession. People, this is the final season of Slate Money Succession because it is the final season of Succession. I am Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hi, hello.
I'm here with Elizabeth Spires. And as ever, we are going to spend the next 10 weeks talking about every single episode of Succession, which obviously this is Succession, so we are fucking well going to be swearing. So, you know, language warning. And every week we are going to have someone fabulous, but it's unlikely that we are going to have anyone quite as fabulous as Mr. Jim Stewart, who is our very special first week guest. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Introduce yourself. Who are you?
How do they not know?
Jim, does anyone not know who you are? When was the last time you met someone who didn't know you? It's like, seriously, almost no introduction.
Well, honestly, I hope there are people who don't know because I don't want to be, you know, I'm not looking to be a huge celebrity. But I think for these purposes, the most relevant fact is I recently published with my co-author, Rachel Abrams, a book called Unscripted, which has been widely compared to Succession as a real life version of Succession. But I want to make clear that in writing this book, I deliberately did not watch a single episode of Succession until the manuscript was done. Because early on, like the editor said, oh my God, this reminds me of Succession. I didn't want to even subliminally be affected by what was going on in the show. So I waited until I was completely done with that. Then I started watching it. And of course, you know, I'm not the average watcher because I'm like, lines, you know, leap out of me. I say, oh, you're right, that actually happened. And so it's been a fascinating experience.
So the first thing that everyone thinks about when they watch Succession is the Murdochs. The second thing that everyone thinks about when they watch Succession is the Redstones. A lot of work does go into looking at real life events and, you know, in the writer's room and trying to sort of incorporate them in ways true or not so true to life. The big picture here, if you look over the three seasons and one episode of Succession that we've had so far, how much of that were you thinking, oh, wow, yeah, this is Sumner right here?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would just say roughly, I think Logan has many characteristics of Sumner Redstone. I would say he's more Sumner than he is Rupert Murdoch in terms of character. Although Sumner, the real Sumner, is in many ways more extreme than Logan Roy. His behavior is more kind of off the chart. So I'd say he strikes me as like maybe 60, 70%.
What you're saying is like that it was just too extreme to be believable in the TV shows. They had to kind of like tone it down a bit.
I think so. I mean, especially the sexual escapades of Sumner. Sumner's entanglement with these mistresses that, you know, actually have, we could talk more about that. But then So, yeah, but Sumner, I don't know really quite how to put this. He's a fascinating, but in many ways, horrible human being. And I guess in the Great Hall of Judgment or something, Sumner's worse than Logan Roy. But so there's all that. Then the drama with the children. I mean, Rupert has four children who are, in various forms of rivalry over the future of the Murdoch media empire.
I think at this point it's up to six. Like, we have to include
Chloe and
Grace.
Is it six now? Yeah, right. Okay. But that part of the Succession is much more Murdoch, because Sumner drove away his son who exited the stage, sold out, disappeared, and has really basically never been seen from since. And his daughter is really the only person, the children were not vying for any kind of control or banding together, any of that. On the other hand, the Sumner Sherry Redstone relationship is in many ways, I think, modeled on the Logan Siobhan relationship. And there are, including in this latest episode, there are like lines that are almost word for word out of quotations from Unscripted.
One of the things which really struck me there is this idea that there's this conceit in Succession, right? Which is that the kids are competing with each other, or at least they were for the first three seasons, to see like which one of them would end up, taking over. That's literally the name of the show. But really, if you look at the Sumner Sherry relationship or the Logan Shiv relationship, even if it had only been one kid, like even then there would still be this struggle. Even then there would still be this dramatic tension, because like the Sumner / Logan patriarch character doesn't want to hand over to anyone, even when there's no one else to hand over to.
Right. And that's very, very much the case in the Redstone situation in Unscripted, where you see the relationship, which we do explore in great detail in the book, between Sumner Redstone and Sherry Redstone, between a aging, powerful, wealthy, incredibly wealthy father and the daughter, is, I think, fascinating. I don't think it's been explored that much in nonfiction context. It's, the relationship between a father and a daughter, fathers and sons, mothers and daughters. Mothers and sons seem to get more attention. Fathers and daughters, I think, not so much. But it's very clear that Sumner Redstone was an extremely competitive person, like Logan Roy. And he treated, in many ways, his daughter as just another competitor who had to be vanquished. He couldn't stand, if she beat him in tennis, he couldn't stand that. If they played a betting game on the jet, then he changed the rules so he would win. He just somehow, he viewed everyone as a competitor, but somehow especially his own children, his own daughter, which, I think competition in any relationship, whether it's, a romantic partnership or family relationship like that, can be very destructive. And you see how it is there with that. Then I just want to add, too, that there's another family here, which figures very prominently in this first episode, which is the Pierces. The Pierces seem to me to be modeled very much on the Bancroft family, which once owned the Wall Street Journal and controlled Journal. And that is, of course, taken from the Murdoch playbook. I think some people think it's the New York Times family. And the veneer of the Pierce properties does sort of have some New York Times elements, but the real life counterpart that I think Murdoch himself lusted after the Wall Street Journal all these years, and finally, after many efforts, got control of it, that was the Bancroft family. And since I also worked at the Wall Street Journal many years, and I got to know the Bancrofts reasonably well when I was there. I mean, I saw them at board meetings. I occasionally, be at cocktail parties with some of them. And they were very much like the Pierces. They're the old money here.
The Pierces are like, we talked about this in season two, the Pierces are like the Bancrofts, but with a major television network. Like the TV aspect of it is doesn't really seem to have much of a real world counterpart. And what it does is it makes their property much more valuable. That, like, you know, PGN is worth, what, $25 billion in season two? It's still worth, apparently, $10 billion in season four. And the Pierces are just like one plutocratic notch higher than the Bancrofts or the Sulzbergers. You know, if you look at the vineyard where they meet in this episode, like, it is modeled pretty obviously, I think, on Rupert's vineyard in LA, Moraga. It's one of those, oh yeah, you know, we are so rich, we just have like a family vineyard, which costs, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to maintain. And that level of wealth, I think, is beyond any mere newspaper family.
Yeah, you know, my favorite part about the way that the Pierces are sketched is that they have this kind of, you know, old money sensibility that says it's crass to talk about money and that any kind of ostentatious display of wealth is terrible. So you have Nan Pierce, you know, sort of bragging that she doesn't like fancy wine. She likes thin, vinegary stuff because she's, you know, salt of the earth at heart. And when they start talking about numbers in the bidding war, she behaves as if it's all too dirty for her to get her hands into. And so she says something like, you know, this makes me feel horrible and it's so confusing. And maybe you understand the financing. I'm not sure I do, but, you know.
That was the best. I think that was my favorite part of the show, Nan Pierce pretending that she doesn't know anything about the money and it's horrible. But then she has the line where it's like horrible people saying different numbers. 8, 9, what's next? I thought that was so wonderful.
Romans, right? What does come after 9? This is so difficult.
What could be after 9?
Yeah, I know. That was that was a very funny line. And I love the wine thing, which says, oh, I just like the, you know, the cheap stuff, that sort of thing. You know, where she sends, you know, her emissary out to say, okay, give me your highest, best offer. Mm-hmm. You know, she's playing that game very, very shrewdly and is
much,
you know,
more shrewdly, I would say, than she did in season two. I think she's really become like an absolutely expert negotiator, partly because she's dealing with a bunch of fuck up kids rather than directly with Logan. You know, like she gets to play the kids off against Logan and she does it incredibly expertly. And Logan is just like exasperated, right? He's like, congratulations, you said the highest number. You know, he cannot believe how dumb his kids are and the fact that like he ended up, you know, he ended up in this bidding war for an asset that he reckoned he could get on the cheap. And he's furious. And obviously, the kids aren't going to wind up buying PGN, right? There's like literally zero chance they're going to like cobble together $10 billion and actually buy this asset.
Well, I, you know, again, in another life, I also covered mergers and acquisitions. So I like was privy to many of these bidding wars that actually happened. And it did strike me that this is it's cinematic, but it's not very realistic. I mean, maybe the kids are that crazy, but I don't think so. They're just plucking these giant numbers out of thin air. Nobody says anything about discount cash flow analysis. The investment banker is just sort of sitting there saying, oh, it, you know, you want to win, you know, let's go up, you know. No, at least the investment bankers I knew would, maybe they were trying to get it up, but they had reams of data and reams of, you know, associates back at Goldman Sachs working, you know, 20-hour days, churning out the numbers and putting out these spreadsheets. And neither side here shows any actual awareness of what is going on in this business they're, you know, ponying up all these billions of dollars for.
Yeah, you tell us.
Should we just recap a little what the episode was about, or are we not doing that? Or we should. We usually do that.
We should. Mm-hmm.
Let's
do that. Emily, what was the
let's set it up.
What was the episode about?
So at the end of the last season, the four kids race to try to prevent Logan from selling his company to the Swedish billionaire. What was his name?
Gojo.
Do we remember his name? Yeah. They tried to race to avoid Gojo acquiring the whole company and thereby, like, I don't know, making them bajillionaires, but not allowing them to actually run the company. So they team up and they make this last mad dash in Italy to try and stop the deal. But then they're kiboshed by their own mother, who makes some last minute change, something, 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 and they're not able to stop the deal. So by the end, we learn that Tom, Shiv's husband, has gone behind her back and basically set her up to fail. And it's a big betrayal. So that's where you end the last season with them kind of on the back foot as losers. But then this season starts and time has passed, which is new for Succession. Typically in the previous seasons, it's gone from like the end of one season, the next episode, the next season is like the day after. In this case, it seems like some amount of time has gone by and the kids have become like a team, which is really new for the show. We haven't seen that before. They're actually all on the same side. Who knows how long that's going to last. He doesn't count, though he would like to. He's the first son. He's the first born.
The first pancake. Connor,
sorry. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so they're all teaming up for the 100, which is sounds like one of these new terrible startups. And they're obviously they're excited about it until the possibility of Pierce comes along, and then that means they can try once again to screw over their father. And by the end of the episode, just to skip ahead, it seems like they did.
Well,
screw over their father. But you're saying it's fleeting and short-lived.
Well, I mean, so the entire premise of this acquisition is that the Gojo acquisition is going to close in 48 hours, and then they're all going to be billionaires, and then they can use their money from the Gojo acquisition to go off and become media moguls. And plan A is to do the 100, and then plan B is to acquire Pierce. You know, and spoiler alert, none of us has seen even episode 2, let alone episodes 3 through 10. But I'm just going to say that the Gojo acquisition is not going to close in 48 hours.
Oh.
Because at that point, Logan stops being the patriarch, right? He's not really in charge anymore. But I think we should just quickly mention the 100, because the 100 is hilarious, right? Quote, yes. According to Kendall, it's Substack meets Masterclass meets The Economist meets The New Yorker, which is such a great Kendall line.
Yes.
All of Kendall's best lines are just super deadpanning business jargon all at once, and then having Roman react to it. So.
Yeah,
but this sounded a little bit like a semaphore to me.
Semaphore slash Puck.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
But it's like the 100 most influential people in the world, and we're just going to get them in one place, and they're going to put out newsletters, and then it's going to be worth billions. And this is such a great idea. Why hasn't anyone done it?
I love that he says at one point, it's going to be the biggest experts on the Arab-Israeli crisis, AI, and gourmet food.
Hot topics all.
But Jen, I mean, is that, I mean, I, you know, it's just on this side of believable. Like, I can easily believe someone launching this, you know, if they had $3 billion and a bunch of ambition. Like, it's not the dumbest media idea I've heard, like, this week.
No, I agree. And it's, but I will say one thing that is bordering on hard to believe, and talking about whether the Gojo deal is going to go through, that they would be financing here's another spoiler alert, $10 billion acquisition of the Pierce interests before they have actually gotten their money from the Gojo sale is pretty hard to believe. I don't know any investment bank on Wall Street that would go out on that limb. I mean, they might be ready, like when the money hits to then move, but they're not going to enter into some kind of binding agreement.
This isn't a binding agreement. It's an indicative something, something, something.
Yeah, that's true. Nobody signed any paper by the end of episode 1.
Yeah, no, this is like playing the genteel Nan Pierce game of like, you know, we will be, you know, polite and mention a number, and you will be polite and say, well, okay, jolly good, now I'm committed to you. And then we will get, you know, my people will talk to your people, and when everything closes, we'll sign the requisite pieces of paper. And then at some point, you will wind up with $10 billion in your bank account. Let's hope it isn't at Silicon Valley Bank. And then, you know, everything will be fine.
Well, one thing I did find interesting was the children's sort of ruminations about how they want to be, they don't want to just be rich people. They want to be forces. They want to be players. They want to be sort of at the table. And that reminded me a little bit of what has happened in the Redstone family, that, you know, Sherry Redstone, the daughter, who's kind of the counterpart to Siobhan, she didn't want to be a mogul. She claimed she didn't want to be a media mogul. She didn't want to be drawn into the family business. She didn't want to be dealing with her father like that all the time. But she had no choice once the women were closing in on him. But once she was in power, once she had that, once she's at Sun Valley mingling with the top moguls of the world, she liked it. You know, she came around. She suddenly enjoyed being the, you know, the chairman of a giant media company. So I found that very plausible, that if not that I've, you know, been in these positions, but once you kind of have a seat like that, it's very hard to give it up. And I think that's why you find in many cases the media mogul types do cling to power. It really, right. It's
like,
fun.
Aren't you happy with your $1 billion? Like, why, you know, why can't you just disappear off and enjoy your $1 billion? Why do you need to run a media company? But this is not just a Sherry Redstone question, right? This is also a Murdoch question. Kids get paid out to the tune of, what, $1 billion or $2 billion each when Fox gets acquired by Disney. And then, you know, Lachlan takes over Rump Fox. And what does James do? He immediately starts buying up, like, the Tribeca Film Festival, South by Southwest. He has an investment in Vice. He, you know, he's like, I need to be a media mogul. It's in my blood. I need to be in charge. And I don't know how much sort of media gossiping you've been doing about, like, what happens when Rupert dies. But there's definitely a bunch of talk about, well, you know, Lachlan has gone way off to the right in terms of politics. The other kids really don't like that. And that once Rupert is gone, the other kids probably have the votes to vote out Lachlan and take over Fox News themselves. And that kind of, like, internal struggling over who gets to be the big media mogul seems like incredibly Succession.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You'd think Connor, who is still running for president, and he's clinging to his 1%, which is a beautiful
that's a plausible,
a beautiful
scenario.
Metaphor.
I feel like that's
him
my,
clinging
that's
to
my
his 1%.
Favorite line in the whole episode, I think, is Connor saying, "If I was to fall under 1%, I fear that I'd become a laughingstock."
Yes.
That was very good.
And then, yeah, and that whole thing with, you know, him wanting to make his wedding into basically, I don't even know, a carnival from 1917 or something with razzmatazz and bum fights. Like,
well, he just wants
but he's also trying to be in the converse, in the game, have power, be, you know, it, just from the political angle.
Well, he wants free media. He doesn't want to spend another $100 million on a hopeless quest. That's kind of Trump-like, you know, creating. Somebody actually analyzed how the value of the free media Trump got, and it was astonishingly huge.
Okay, let's take a break to monetize this podcast with some ads.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So Jim, in your sort of, you know, delving into how these billionaires think about money, this happens twice in this episode. Connor's like, $100 million is real money. You know, I'm rich, but like, I don't want to just burn $100 million. And then there's also that bit where, you know, the kids are talking about how much to increase their bid, and Roman's like, $500 million. This is real money. You know, it's 500 times 1,000 times 1,000. Like, people, this is actual money that we could spend on actual things. And there seems to be that level of, like, obviously they can take private jets, they can rent out houses, they can do the spending in the sort of seven-figure range, and that's, like, whatever, it's no big deal. But the minute it gets, but it's kind of when it gets into the nine-figure range that they start thinking, ooh, now I'm actually spending money.
Well, it's never been entirely clear to me how much money the children have at their fingertips. I mean, again, they obviously live large, they have what more than any normal person would ever dream of wanting. But there was an exchange in there between Connor and his girlfriend, fiance, where she says, oh, well, you've spent $100 million. You've still got plenty of money, right? And he says, oh, yeah, right, of course. But he does it in a way that made me think, maybe you strip $100 million out of him and maybe they don't have that much more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
money.
I think he doesn't, because remember when he went up to Connor, went up to Logan and asked for like a loan. Like, I think Connor's already spending some of this like Gojo money before it's even arrived.
Yeah, it seems like it. And then, but then again, in the conversation, Roman of all people seems to be the only, I mean, Kendall and Siobhan don't, you know, as you point out, they're like tossing around billions. Like, it's like you're playing bridge or something. I mean, it doesn't seem to have any real meaning to them except that they can, what they have to do to win. And Roman is the one kind of bringing them back down to earth. Say, wait a minute, we are talking about $500 million here.
He still seems like his character, I mean, for the first few seasons, his character was easily manipulated by the father. Like, the Logan just had control over this kid. Like, in season one, when he doesn't raise his hand, you know, to allow Kendall to take over the board or whatever. And then even in season three, it was up until the Gojo thing happened, he was sort of in Logan's pocket. And now it seems like instead of becoming his own person, he's just in the pocket of his siblings. Like they convinced him to give up on the 100 and do this deal. He knows it's too much money, but he's just going along. Like he just has no backbone
at all.
It's also
part of his arc that he's a little bit of a Cassandra figure. There's a lot of foreshadowing with him. And he also, you know, in the first season in particular, he was portrayed as a very frivolous character, you know, who seemingly wasn't too invested in the business. And then you see these sort of flashes of seriousness with him that are very selective and they're sort of dispersed so that most of the time he does have this kind of, you know, superficial persona, but then he's the voice of reason in a lot of these cases.
Can we talk very briefly about architecture here? Because there was that incredible establishing shot at the beginning when the kids were all in that ludicrous mansion in LA. And it's so Kendall, right? Out of everyone in the show, like only Kendall would feel the need to rent that like insane $250 million hilltop mansion above LA to reassure himself that he is rich and powerful. I feel like neither Roman nor Siobhan has that kind of level of insecurity, but like they will go along with Kendall if he needs that. He needs that.
Yeah. Was that Kendall's house? I thought it was Roman's Los Angeles
Really? Why did you think it was Roman? I felt it was 100% Kendall.
I don't know. Because he was there at first by himself, like earnestly doing, you know, the presentation of logos for the 100. I was just like, oh, look at Roman with his house. Wow. But I don't know. Yeah, that's what I thought.
It seemed like more of a power house than Roman would have.
Yeah.
I thought. But
yeah.
I was saying,
it's fair.
I think the set designer for this show deserves some kind of incredible awards because it's really beautifully done. And there are all these carefully placed details that are signifiers in that world. And again, I thought the Pierce mansion was incredibly revealing of that old money taste, as opposed to those slick, glossy surfaces that Kendall goes for. Where is that Pierce house? Is that in wine country?
Yeah, I assumed it was in Napa.
Well, there are palm trees all over the place. And it looked out over hills and, you know, so
Southern California wine country, then they wouldn't have had to take a private jet to get there from LA, right?
No, that's kind of, well, it could be Northern California, you know, it could be, they would have flown the jet up to go to, you know, Sonoma.
That's why I assumed it was
palm
Napa.
Trees?
But yeah, you find palm trees.
It was a very Palm Beach look. But my first thought was, oh, this is old money Palm Beach here. You know, the salmon color dining room and the pale blue living room and that, you know, chintz upholstery.
Really, the one thing I covet more than anything else in Succession, you know, there's one of the great things about Succession is it makes everyday luxuries seem kind of distasteful and nasty, but oh my God, I want that wallpaper. The wallpaper in that house is amazing.
Yes. The real old money crowd there, I think you would have noticed a little threadbare, you know, something that really needed to be reupholstered, but they're not going to actually bother to do that. I mean, maybe you could have pushed that just a little bit, but and then by contrast, like the Logan's dark wood paneled, you know, baronial, you know, masculine looking apartment that he's in for the birthday party. I mean, this stuff is all pitch perfect. And really does convey, you know, these character traits of the occupants.
Sumner Redstone have wired his entire apartment with like CCTV cameras?
Oh yes. I mean that's actually true because the Beverly Park mansion, Sumner's Beverly Park mansion was completely wired with cameras, which, you know, the things that were recorded on those cameras go way beyond anything I've seen on Succession. But yes, absolutely, that is right out of the Redstone playbook.
The other thing I need to ask you about the Redstone playbook is the absolutely wonderful way that Carrie introduces herself to Greg's girlfriend. Greg's like, this is Carrie. And she's like,
really
I'm his friend, assistant, and advisor. which is a great phrase. And you, you know, wrote a whole book basically about Sumner's various girlfriends. How would they introduce themselves? Would they say something like that, or would they just say girlfriend?
Or in the case of Sydney Holland, who even looks a little bit like Carrie. She would introduce herself as his fiance. I mean, she wore the 9-carat diamond and flashed it around. And one thing I have to get to I never could quite get to the bottom of, like, they were eternal fiancés. I mean, they were never actually getting married. In fact, you know, she goes off and, like, supposedly becomes engaged to this other guy in the picture. And I don't know quite how she strung that along for so long. But there were many financial benefits to being a fiancé rather than a wife. A wife, you know, she probably would have had to go through the prenuptial agreements and all of that. But as a fiancé, you've got free reign to siphon off as much as you can. And, you know, one of the astonishing things in the real life, unscripted, is that his two girlfriends made off with over $150 million. And they were actually close to taking over the business empire, which is a line that, at least so far, Succession has in mind. But I will say, you can see coming, Carrie is insinuating herself, because she's friend, advisor, whatever she calls herself now. It's clear that she's having, you know, this romantic entanglement with Logan, and it'll be interesting to see, does she follow the redstone path here, and is she able to insinuate herself more deeply into the financial planning of the future? She's now a player in the succession.
Carrie is showing some teeth in this episode for the first time.
Definitely.
For the first time. We haven't seen her teeth before, and she's like, what's her name? Is it Bridget Randomfuck?
Yeah, I know. She shows herself to be a very tough character and a pretty shrewd operator in those mm-hmm. those opening scenes there.
Yeah. So we should talk about the Disgusting Brothers now. This is our opportunity. Yes. But first, my first question is, can you tell me how old Logan is? What birthday are they celebrating? I didn't have time to sort of try and
do
the calculations.
It wasn't like the big one was in Dundee, right? I feel like the one in Dundee was 70, 75, something like that.
I should have done my internet.
And so this is probably like one, you know, I'm going to guess it's like 76. It's not a big birthday. It's just like having a few people around to his apartment.
Oh, that's interesting, because Sumner was much older. He was celebrating. When the women moved in, they threw a big party for him for his 90th birthday, and then another one for 92. Obviously, Logan is younger. How old is Rupert at this point?
He's 92, I think. And I think we have to mention that he recently got engaged again.
And
said
he
that he looked forward to spending the second half of his life with
his fiance. I have to say,
which is maybe the most Logan Roy thing he's ever said.
It's a glorious, glorious quote, and like it is the greatest Cindy Adams column of all time. And if you haven't read the Cindy Adams announcement of Rupert Murdoch's fifth engagement, it is one of the great pieces of modern journalism.
Okay, according to the internet, breaking. Logan Roy is 83, and season one he had his 80th birthday party.
Wait, it's been 3 years between season one and season four?
Wow.
Yeah,
that seems right, doesn't it?
It feels like it's gone by much more quickly than that.
Each season's like kind of like a year. But 83, that kind of makes more sense to me than in his 70s, because he, in this episode, just really seems to be grappling with his existential reality.
So how old is Connor?
Taking Colin... I don't know. I can Google that too. I can do this live on the podcast if you want. I feel like Connor's in his 50s, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
At least.
But yeah, so we have this kind of crappy birthday party on the Upper East Side with a half-hearted singing of Happy Birthday that Logan hates. The only person that Logan really wants to talk to there is Carrie. And he looks around and he's like, isn't there like a cardinal or someone important here? And like, who are these people? And I hate them, and they're eating my food, and I'm just going to go off with my bodyguard and have dinner because I can't stand any of them. And that kind of deep misanthropy is very Logan.
Yeah. And then he goes off and has dinner with his bodyguard and then starts talking about like what happens when you die.
He has intimations of mortality. Meanwhile, you know, cousin Greg is having a rummage in the guest bedroom.
Oh, by the way, the whole, I want to get back to Greg, but that whole intimation mortality, that discussion, that's very, very close to some things that actually happened with Sumner Redstone. He says he doesn't really believe in the afterlife, but then he kind of waffles on that a bit. But Sumner confided in one or more of his mistresses that he feared this final reckoning, and that one reason he kept saying he was going to live forever and that he couldn't die was that he was self-aware enough to know that if there was a final judgment, he was going to fail. But what I found kind of biblical about the story, and we may see this yet, I don't know, in Succession, but Sumner Redstone got his final judgment long before he died. And it was, he was in his own hell for those last years, a hell of his own making. And I think that's one of the powerful messages I found in the whole story is that, you know, Don't wait for that, you know, deathbed conversion, because you may get what you deserve long before that.
What do you mean he got what he deserved?
Well, he was a horrible person, and he ended up in the waning years of his life incredibly rich, with no friends, no real lovers, isolated from his family, crying constantly, being abused by these women. It was a horrible, nightmarish existence as he both deteriorated physically and mentally. It was when you meet somebody who cares about you and loves you. I mean, fortunately for him, Sherry came through in the end, but his existence was miserable.
I feel like you're seeing hints of that. I mean, you've seen hints of that throughout this series of Logan being afraid of death and getting sicker and kind of losing it a little bit. And then at the end of this episode, when he's just like by himself in a chair watching ATN, yes, like so many elderly people in this country are at night watching Fox, you know, and the only person he has to call is Sid, you know, the head of ATN, to complain. Like, he's obviously quite isolated and alone.
Oh my God. Can we have more Sid, please? She's my number one favorite character in this entire show.
she is good.
More than Nan?
Actually, you know who used to be my favorite character and is now off in Milan shopping forever is Marcia.
Marcia. That's a great line with it. She's shopping forever. That's when I realized, oh, Carrie is, oh, she's a tough character here.
Oh, yeah. You don't get into that position if you're not, right?
But I diverted from Greg and Tom because they're big in this episode.
Yeah, and can I, like, also just when you come into the design aspects of it, they both have extremely expensive, very well-fitting suits on, which is new for them, right? We remember back when the kids were all making fun of Greg, making fun of Tom for looking like a Midwestern accountant, you know, salesman guy in Roman's apartment. And now suddenly Tom is looking extremely sleek at this party, very smoothly, you know, well put together. And even Greg is, right? Even Greg is wearing like clearly a bespoke suit. Like, when you're that tall, you know, you need to have this stuff like made to measure. And it was, right? And they've both like climbed up to the point at which Greg can just like waltz into the birthday party and say, well, I'm a cousin, I get a plus one, which, you know, back in the early seasons, he would never have had the chutzpah to do that, let alone to, you know, go for a rummage in the guest bedroom.
I mean, the clothes in the show are amazing to begin with. There was a great New Yorker piece, I want to say last year, that just talked about the fashion choices on Succession, how reflective they are of very specific, nuanced hierarchies of class. So the fact that, you know, Tom starts out wearing this very puffy jacket and Roman says something like, jacket puffy enough, you know, and sort of points it out. But there are also more subtle things, you know, Logan and Kendall are often wearing the same black hat, and particularly when they might be aligned or there's some hint of that. So along with the set design, the costuming is incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Shiv was very beige.
The girlfriend's purse.
The girlfriend's purse. I mean, well, yeah, no, Bridget random fact. It's like, yeah, she walks in with these like ankle boots and white socks and just like stands out like a sore thumb. Like Logan sees her coming in the door and it takes him roughly 1 second to go, who the fuck is that, right? She clearly doesn't belong. And then she right. tags Bun Pierce in an Instagram photo, and that's how Kendall finds out that Logan is bidding on Pierce.
Yeah, yes, that's a great twist. And then she wants to take a selfie with Logan. That pretty much said it all. But Greg was more assertive here than the previous season. I mean, at one point he says, "Well, look, I'm a cousin. I'm a member of the family. I'm practically a son," or something like that. I mean, he's very, he's really asserting his right to be at the table here in a way that I don't think he did in previous episodes.
Yeah, I think maybe there's this sort of kid-shaped vacuum now in Logan's life with the three, you know, all being persona non grata at this point. And he's like, I can just step into that hole and you know, take the place of like some other fuck up like Roman, and how hard can it be? And maybe he's not wrong. You know, clearly he seems to have an ability to interact with Logan that Tom still finds very difficult. That incredibly awkward conversation between Tom and Logan, where Tom's like, you know, can I still be your son if I get divorced with your daughter? And Logan's like, fuck off, this guy's off his tree.
No, that's I think that's a great scene. I love that scene because there's Tom groveling as usual, but then at the end of it, you know, Logan really doesn't say much, and then Tom says, "Well, are we good?" And Logan gives this incredibly non-committal answer, and Tom's nodding, say, "Oh yeah, okay. Oh, that's so reassuring. And, you know, I'm so glad to hear that." And then Logan sticks another knife between his ribs, and I said, "Okay, this guy Tom is heading for the chopping block. He got no reassurance there, none."
And he screwed up the deal, right? Tom is supposed to be like working this Pierce deal, and he basically tipped off his soon-to-be ex-wife about it and set the whole falling apartness, sorry for that word, in motion. And I don't think he actually realized it until after it happened, and then he was thinking, does it matter?
It was 50%.
It doesn't matter who tipped them off.
It was 50% Tom and 50% Bridget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm curious.
Yeah, the two newcomers.
Did you find the end of this episode, the sort of unravel final, you know, I guess it's the final, the end of the Siobhan Tom relationship or whatever. Did you find that moving or poignant or anything? I'm
just
curious.
I think one of the weaknesses of the show, not that there are any weaknesses in this show, but one of the weaknesses of the show is that we never see why Tom and Shiv got married in the first place. We never see what they see in each other. Like, you don't really believe in the marriage to begin with. The whole wedding in season one is basically just an excuse to get that Kendall plot point in there. And, you know, and like when the marriage starts falling apart, you know, during the sort of next Cove Please Julia scene, like you're like, well, of course it's falling apart because there was never anything there to begin with. And so should we feel sad that the marriage is ending? Like, sure. But, you know, doesn't Roman have a line about that when he's talking to Nan Pierce? He's like, what is that line?
Said something like, "Don't you hate it when love dies?"
Yeah, she says, "I'm getting a divorce," and Nan says, "I'm sorry to hear that." And Roman says, "Yes, it's a sad, sad day when love dies." And like, and clearly, it's like that's. I think my take on this is basically the same as Roman's, right?
I thought it was a moving scene. Clearly, a lot of emotion and regret, and
I think in the last season they did kind of credibly have Tom's character demonstrate that he really had feelings for Shiv, and there seemed to be an imbalance because she didn't reciprocate that, and to Felix's point, they don't really articulate why that is. But I think Matthew McFadden's a good actor, and he made it feel convincing.
Yeah, and I think she did a good job too. It seemed like she had a lot going on and was actually sad and just couldn't bring herself to admit that or admit that she's had any feelings at all, which makes sense given the family she grew up in. Those kids can't express their feelings at all. So, of course, but you could see on on her face that she was, you know, that it was a sad moment. And then they sort of lay down in the bed and hold hands. I thought that was moving.
I thought it was kind of moving, but I agree with Felix that from the minute they appeared in this movie, you know they're doomed. This is never going to work. And the open marriage that's declared on the night of the wedding, you know, that's not a good, you know, that's not a optimistic way to be embarking on the marriage. And of course, it finally does. So I felt there was like no real surprise there, but I did find myself feeling kind of bad for them.
Yeah, I feel bad for them. But
what tore them apart wasn't even the, you know, declaration of the open relationship on the wedding night. What tore them apart really was that he went to Logan and betrayed her, and like she couldn't. That was it. That was the end. Like, Logan basically destroyed their relationship, and that whole competition you were talking about earlier sort of manifested in that way. To play to one side of this, like, fissured family, you know what I mean? If it was like a normal family, that wouldn't be a dynamic that would do anything.
Like all major media organizations, we are ad supported. Let's get some ads here and come back to more media gossip.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
I would love to just make a note about the architecture here, because it is a stark distinction from Kendall's big mansion in L.A. Siobhan then flies back to New York and goes into her apartment in New York. And in a weird twist, which is very un-Succession, we get this exterior establishing shot of her walking into 120 Broadway, and it says very clearly 120 Broadway, which isn't even a residential building, right? And it's directly opposite Chase Manhattan Plaza, 28 Liberty, which is used as the headquarters of Waystar Royco. And obviously it's nighttime because, you know, she's just flown back from LA and it's the middle of the night. But even then, the apartment feels a little bit cold and dark and not, you know, it's expensive clearly with big windows. Again, that's clearly not 120 Broadway, which has small windows, but like it's not it's the opposite of a show-offy building. It's in a kind of weirdly non-neighborhood. It's not in a nice neighborhood at all. It's down in the financial district, and there's this kind of dog in a crate, and there's not really any art in the walls, and it feels very sort of temporary and utilitarian. And the opposite of the sort of grand, flashy LA lifestyle that Kendall is leaving. And I feel like that little bit of architectural scene setting was fascinating to me.
I just want to note that I love that the dog is named Mondale.
Yes, I was thinking about that too.
In one of the seasons, the Pierces, that was a signal to the Pierces that they were like good people because their dog's named Mondale. They're like, oh, maybe they are a little liberal inside.
We should do some favorite lines here. Jim, did you have like a favorite line in this episode?
Well, we've mentioned some of them as we've gone along. I don't know that I'd call this a favorite line, but one that really leaped out at me as being so close to a Redstone thing that's in Unscripted is when Logan gets on the phone and wants to say to his daughter, you know, I won't use his language, but you've never done a thing. You've never accomplished anything. You are you are a failure. It was scathing. And it's exactly what Sumner used to write emails like that to his daughter, Sherry. But unlike Logan, he would copy the top executives at his companies and members of the board.
Oh my God.
And would call her names that, you know, I'm not going to repeat even on a podcast, so that everybody saw this. I mean, it was cruel and humiliating. But that line really leaped out at me as being exactly the way Sumner treated his own daughter. And here's Logan, you know, it's not enough to just like lose this takeover battle, but he's, you know, heaps this scathing criticism on his own daughter. That made a big impression on me. And again, very, very true to life to the Redstone situation.
Emily?
I like the line. I mean, I already said my favorite line, which was 8-9, what's next? But I guess a runner-up would be...
Yeah, 9-B.
They have the Saudi investors just like waiting outside the house.
So
and they keep putting them off. And then Kendall says... He says to his assistant, Jess, find them a journalist to burn with cigarettes while they wait. And it was just...
yeah, that.
And she kind of like waits a beat and then fake laughs. And I thought that was great.
That was...
Like, these are the media awesome. Moguls, people. They do not care about the media.
Elizabeth.
Yeah, my actual favorite was Roman replying to different people saying different numbers and saying, you know, so confusing. What comes next? 9-9-B? But I also have some notes on, besides Kendall's explanation of the 100, where he calls it Substack meets Masterclass meets The Economist meets The New Yorker, it was also described as an indispensable bespoke info hub or a high calorie info snacks. So I love anything Kendall describes in business jargon.
Info snacks.
Yeah, no, that was...
I know about those.
My favorite version of that was when he says, "We have an ethos of nonprofit, but packed crazy margins."
I can't believe they walked away from this amazing idea.
I mean, like, who doesn't want to have a nonprofit that is incredibly profitable? I love that. But there was this one line where, like, Shiv is trying to explain why she took the call from, like, the Democratic politician. And, like, she was trying to explain that the 100 might not actually happen. And she turns to her brothers and she goes, she turns to Roman and she talks about Kendall. And she goes, he might go on a killing spree in 7-Eleven and you might get your dick stuck in an AI jerk machine. And it's like, they do still hate each other.
It's fair.
But I think my number one favorite line, honestly, is not even a line that anyone says. It's a quick little thing. I don't know if you noticed it in the opening credits where they have a freeze frame of Logan's TV, like, you know, Fox News TV station, and the Chiron on the bottom says, China hack could see 40 million Americans entombed in their cars.
I missed that. What? 40 million?
40 million.
Wow. That's an evolution from previous seasons, which was more transphobic, I thought.
Yeah. No, China's just going to, like, you know, hack our electric vehicles and entomb us in our cars.
Oh, shoot. I wanted to ask all you all, I was trying to understand that Gojo deal because Logan keeps saying he has ATN. So is the Gojo deal going to wind up being like the Fox Disney deal where he gets to keep, you know, the gross TV station no one wants kind of a thing?
Yeah, I'm a little bit unclear about
that the
because like
assumption?
Is this a merger of equals? Is Gojo buying Roystar Waco and then spinning off ATN so, like, ATN just becomes, a Fox Corp? Or is this, like, Logan is still running a bunch of the combined company and also, like, doing a fill-in acquisition of PGN at the same time?
I don't know. It's confusing. I can't wait to see the next week's episode.
Can you all please email us on slatemoney@slate.com and explain the structure of the Gojo Waystar deal, because we need to have this explained to us.
I need to understand how it works.
Yeah, I agree it was confusing. Yes.
Hopefully all will be revealed. And let's remind listeners that Felix has predicted the Gojo deal is going to fall apart and the Pierce deal is going to fall apart. So we'll be holding Felix to that throughout season.
Let me just say this, right? We've had 3 full seasons of media moguls trying to do deals, and so far we haven't had a single deal actually get done through to fruition. I feel like this is a safe prediction. Nothing ever actually happens in this show.
The Israeli AI company. The Israeli AI company that was acquired.
It was? Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. That's the one.
On which predictive note, I think we will just wait and see what happens in season two, and we will be back next week for a season two recap. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Saturday with more regular State Money and Jim Stewart. Thanks so much for coming on. It was fantastic.
That was lots of fun.
Thanks to Patrick Fort for producing, putting this whole show together.